From the City of Angels near the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie, and welcome to Coast AM. Later on tonight, those open lines. Well, the hurricane season started off pretty quiet, but not right now. The leading edge of Hurricane Gonzalo moved into Bermuda on Friday night, pounding the British territory with fierce winds and heavy surfs as a powerful Category 3 storm that could now raise coastal seas as much as 10 feet. Ebola, that's the big word this week. Poor communication and competent staff meant that the World Health Organization failed to react swiftly to the Ebola outbreak in Africa, according to a report. An internal document sent that those involved failed to see some fairly plain writing on the wall. Separately, sources close to the WHO say that multiple failures in the outbreak occurred in the early stages. In the worst affected countries, Liberia, Guinea, Sierra Leone, the Ebola virus has now killed 4,546 people with cases of infection numbering 9,191 people. And concerns about even remote chances of Ebola exposure rippled from a U.S. airline to a ship off of Belize, with the airline trying to contact now hundreds of more passengers who flew with an infected nurse and a cruise liner quarantining a health worker linked to an Ebola patient scare. Jeez, it just doesn't stop. Military and White House officials say that the fierce fighting in the Syrian border town of Kobani has created an opportunity to take out large numbers of Islamic State fighters that are pouring into the battle from everywhere. Now, though the fighting has raised concerns that the vital town could still fall to the Islamic State, Army General Lloyd Austin, the head of the U.S. Central Command, claimed that there's an upside for the U.S. and its allies, and that is, of course, wiping out a lot of those people who come in to fight. At least 16 people have been killed, 11 injured in an accident at a pop concert south of Seoul, Korea. South Korea, they say a ventilation grate collapsed when a group of concert goers who were standing on top of it, it collapsed and fell 33 feet into an underground parking area, killing those 16 people. A U.S. plane on a top-secret two-year mission to space has returned to planet Earth and landed in California. The aircraft resembles a miniature space shuttle, and it's known, of course, as the X-37B. We've got the full story for you in Hot Stories at coasttocoastam.com. Spent 674 days in orbit around the planet. The purpose of the plane remains unclear. Theory was that it was taking a look at China's space lab. That was been downplayed, though, by a number of experts. And a comet is speeding toward a close encounter with Mars. Comet Sighting Spring is expected to come within 87,000 miles of Mars at 2:27 p.m. Eastern Time on Sunday. Very close for a comet flyby. The space rock is moving at 126,000 miles an hour. Let's check in with Dr. Stephen Cates. Dr. Sky, is it going to hit Mars at all, Stephen?
Well, George, we're hoping it doesn't, but the latest that the NASA folks and JPL gave it as odds back in April of 2013 was 1 in 120,000. But as you mentioned just before we're here on the air, the comet, folks, is this amazing object. Get a load of this, George. The size of a small mountain, putting that in perspective, probably the size maybe a quarter mile in diameter, and that's on the small scale. As you mentioned, Sunday, West Coast, late morning, East Coast, early afternoon, it gets very close to Mars, which is exceptional, George, in the time of all humankind. We've never seen something like this. And just to put it in relative terms, if this were something that were coming past the Earth, could you imagine all the craziness that would be surrounding this most amazing encounter? But here's what we're looking at. On the surface of Mars, the Curiosity and Opportunity craft, spacecraft, the rovers, are hoping to image this from the surface. But if it were visible here on the Earth, it would light up the sky, get a load of this, probably with the brilliance of a half moon with a giant tail stretching all across the sky.
That's cool.
And it's so amazing, George, that the worst is not over for this, because a lot of the spacecraft are on the other side of Mars when this particular comet comes by. But an hour later, after its close approach. Mars moves, get a load of this, within 17,000 miles of the debris field.
Jeez.
So this is an exciting story. DrSky.com, George, as always, and photorecon.net. And we'll be keeping our fingers crossed. But no, I don't think it's going to hit, but stranger things have happened.
But could the tail, Stephen, wipe out some of those orbital satellites?
It's very possible, George, but I think since no one knows for sure, we're trying to safekeep and protect those spacecraft. But only time will tell, because this is a relatively new comet. It's come from the deep part of the solar system. So what people are speculating is nobody knows, but the real damage, of course, is in that tail. And it's actually going to press up onto the surface of the upper atmosphere of Mars. So it's anybody's guess, George.
All right. Thank you so much, Dr. Sky, Stephen Cates. And what else is up in the sky? It's time for our weekly report with Peter Davenport from the National UFO Reporting Center. Peter, what do we got tonight?
Well, good evening, George. And it's almost as if these aliens know we're approaching Halloween, because it's getting weirder and weirder all the time. When I do one of these reports, I'm now confronted with a potpourri, with a smorgasbord of reports to present to our listeners. But let's go back 3 days, Tuesday, the 14th of October, about 7:30 p.m. East Coast time, Raymondville, New York. It's located about as far north in New York State as you can go, up north of Albany, right on the St. Lawrence River, just across from Canada. And a gentleman called the hotline to report that he and his 14-year-old daughter were standing outside admiring the evening sky, and they became aware of a very bright, strobing yellow light that appeared to be above the clouds. They couldn't see it directly. They could only see the flashes and the strobing from it. And what they found very interesting was that right after it streaked overhead and disappeared from their sight, there were, they think, two or possibly more fighter aircraft pursuing it, apparently, or at least flying in the same direction as that yellow light had gone. Minutes later, I got a report, a telephone call from Parrishville, New York. That's about 25 miles south of Raymondville. And a man and wife pulled into the driveway of their home in Parrishville. And the first thing they noticed was there were fighter aircraft above their head. They looked up and were very surprised to see three very prominent orange lights in the night sky. As the aircraft orbited them, the three orange lights seemed to extinguish, one right after the other, and just disappear from their view. We should have that report up on our website sometime tomorrow.
Okay.
Lots going on. Same night, again, the 14th of October, gentleman in downtown Denver looking into the southern sky was quite shocked to see somewhere between 10 and 14 yellow lights in a cluster moving from west to east in front of him. You know, the interesting thing, George, about a sighting like that, the gentleman who called the hotline struck me as being very sane, very sober-minded, very eloquent. I believed every word he was telling me, which is not always the case when you run a hotline, of course. But what strikes me as strange is not the 14 yellow lights, or approximately 14 yellow lights. It's the fact that an event like that can occur and only one person sees it or sees it and reports it, even stranger than the objects he saw, in my opinion.
It's exciting, and we're getting close to November 8th, Peter, in Toronto.
Boy, I'm looking forward to it, and I should have plenty of interesting material to talk about, George. One of the things I want to talk about is that very tragic crash of the F-15 in Deerfield, Virginia, on the 25th of August this year. You know, I've meant to mention it in my past appearances. Something very, very peculiar is going on there. For a seasoned combat pilot to have an emergency at 40,000 feet or thereabouts and not be able to get out of his plane is very
unusual. That is weird. Okay, so, Peter, I look forward to seeing you there. And just added to our Toronto event, and full details at coasttocoastam.com, Giorgio Tsoukalos from Ancient Aliens is going to be out there with me. An Australian man had a spider removed from his stomach. We've got this story for you at coasttocoastam.com if you can stomach it. After it burrowed its way into his body and survived for 3 days before being removed. Yuck. In Tallahassee, Florida, a satanic group wants to put up a holiday display in the Florida's Capitol Rotunda that shows the devil descending into hell. The Florida Department of Management Services banned the temple's holiday display last year because they deemed it grossly offensive for the holidays. You know, when author and critic Peter Biebergall first explored his older brother's record collection at the age of 11, he discovered what so many of us have found in rock and roll. Magic riddled with the occult and mystical images and ideas. What does it all mean? In a moment, Peter joins us on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, Peter Biebergall's with a Season of the Witch, How the Occult Saved Rock and Roll. Peter is also the author of Too Much to Dream, A Psychedelic American Boyhood, and co-authored The Faith Between Us. He writes frequently on the intersection of popular culture, religion, and science, as well as reviews on science fiction and fantasy. And in Season of the Witch, he talks about, of course, why so many musicians have covered their albums with occult symbols, lyrics with stuff full of myth and legend. And here he is on Coast to Coast, Peter Biebergall. Peter, welcome.
Thank you, George. Really great to be here.
Looking forward to this. How did you start investigating the occult into music with all the things you've done in your career?
Well, like you said, it really started when I was a kid. And I think that interest never left. I was really seduced by what I found in those records on those album covers. I was a product of the 1970s. It was growing up, you know, post 1960s, the sort of resurgent interest, I think, really what we might call a second occult revival that was going on, particularly at the end of the 60s. It was sort of established with the hippies and the psychedelic movement that it was really looking towards the East for some kind of new spiritual experience to deal with what they saw as the chaos in American society. In the 70s, by the time I was coming of age, things were getting a little bit darker, you might say. The 60s failed ultimately. I think people felt that it did fail in its promise of the great spiritual liberation that people had hoped. The war didn't quite end the way they thought. There were the Manson murders. There was the stabbing at the Rolling Stones Altamont concert, you know, just a few months really after Woodstock.
Assassinations all over the place.
Exactly. And these were people, the assassinations of people who the younger generation really thought were going to change the world.
Yeah.
So things weren't looking good. But there was also a kind of playfulness that people wanted. I think they wanted a return to a sense that, yes, there was a darkness, but it was also some ways to enjoy, I guess, how some of this stuff gets expressed. So you have this really interesting mix in the 70s of things like, well, let's say, Dungeons and Dragons role-playing games. Or I remember all the great Warren magazines like Creepy and Eerie. I bet many of your listeners are familiar with those great horror comics of the 1970s. There was, if you remember, a resurgence of monster movies, creature double feature, and
they were everywhere.
Everywhere, all the UHF stations got the packages. You know, Sunday mornings. I remember tearing into the Saturday morning newspaper just to see what was going to be on creature double feature that day when I was a kid. I couldn't wait, and I collected the monster magazines.
How about the models? Remember the Aurora monster models?
Fantastic stuff, and some of those were kind of strangely sadistic. There was one that was a hanging cage and actually had the torture implements, you know, and these were...
Yeah, you're right.
Kids. Vincent Price had the shrunken head. He was the spokesperson for the shrunken head kit that you would wait for your apples to dry out and turn into little monster heads. So, you know, there was that, but on the other side of that playful sort of playfulness, there was also, I think, a real interest in things like the paranormal, of course. This is when we start to have shows like In Search Of, and we start to really see. I remember being able to buy those, which I'm sure you've talked about on your show, the ESP cards.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
The Zener cards, I think they were called, right? And you could get the packs of those, and they had the circle, the star, the square, the triangle, and you would try to do that with your friends. And Ouija boards, of course, were ubiquitous. At that time.
Well, and you mentioned Vincent Price, Peter. When he was working on Thriller with Michael Jackson, they wanted him to come in with that spooky laugh and all that look. They made him an offer. They really didn't want to pay him. So what they said was, look, we'll give you 10% of the profits of this album, or $25,000. What do you want? And he said, I want the cash. So they wrote him a check for $25,000, and he estimated before he died, he said he thought that 10% would have been worth $250 million. Unbelievable.
Right. Who would have thought,
yep,
you know, that it could have turned into that? But that's also another great example, you know, of where that kind of imagery and even in the highest point of pop culture was something that captured the imagination. And so that capturing of the imagination is really what I wanted to explore in this book, because it had captured mine so much. And so, again, being a kid that was surrounded by this imagery, that loved these things, I would, you know, sneak into my brother's room and listen to his records and listen to Alice Cooper and David Bowie and Led Zeppelin and Black Sabbath. And something about the way these images and these ideas were captured in music, it felt more potent somehow than the Aurora model kits and the Monster magazine.
Yeah, you're right.
It seemed real because these were real people, and it wasn't that they were just saying things. They were making some incredible music, and this music was riveting and powerful, especially, you know, when you're 11, 12 years old, and I had really just before that had been listening to the Bay City Rollers. So, suddenly, you know, come across
Neil Sedaka, one of my favorite guys.
That's right. And so to have this experience with even something like Revolution 9 on the White Album of the Beatles was both terrifying to hear these kinds of sounds come out of the stereo, but it was also really exhilarating. And I could tell right away, and my brother helped by showing me how on the Beatles album covers you could search for clues to Paul's death and supposed death. And we would look at the Alice Cooper covers together, and he would point out things that he interpreted, you know, that these things meant. And suddenly it felt like there was this secret language that was part of the music and the culture, and the musicians themselves, their lives always seemed to be filled with chaos. And of course, underneath all of that was another energy, which is also an energy of rebellion, which is sex. So, and that's a very potent thing when you're 11 and 12 years old. So all of that came together in a way of creating for me this sense that there was really something dramatically, as you put it, magical here. And what I discovered over time, and as I grew up and as I went to school and started studying religion and American popular culture, that, wow, I was just one person, but actually many people were experiencing this kind of thing in terms of how the music had affected them so profoundly in this way, and how even for those people that don't, say, believe in magic or the occult, you don't have to still find something really seductive and exciting about the way in which musicians have used this imagery, have explored these ideas with their music. And I think, and the argument I try to make in the book, is that this ultimately really shaped the spiritual identity of rock and roll, and that if we were to remove these occult aspects, these mystical aspects, I think that the history of rock and by extension popular music would look and sound very different in both its presentation and its performance, in its sound, and even in sort of the ways in which we as a culture react to it, right? That's so much part of the relationship. It's not just what happens in the album. It's also about how it's interpreted and what the fans are doing and what they want from it, the desire that we have sometimes to make there be meaning, whether there is or not.
Peter, hold on. We're going to come back. We're going to talk more about your incredible work, Season of the Witch, on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. Tomorrow night, you're going to hear a wonderful new voice hosting the program for you on Saturday. Now, when I say a new voice, new to the program, Coast to Coast AM, but not new to broadcasting at all, Connie Willis. This is going to be exciting, Connie.
That's very nice of you. It is exciting. I'm excited. I mean, my gosh, it's Coast to Coast AM. Thank you so much.
Well, you know what? You were born for doing a show like this. I mean, you're a remote viewer. You're a broadcaster. You've got all the tools necessary. And I'm sure you're going to tell a lot of people tomorrow what you do and what you've done. But, hey, I'm looking forward to this, Connie.
Well, I appreciate that. And what a nice surprise to hear from you tonight to welcome me like this. You know, I think you're right. I think I was born to do it. And I think it was more of the fact that because of weird things kind of come to me in life. So I have this passion to try to figure out what it's all about. So I can ask pretty good questions only because of the fact that I'm one of those people that get chased by these crazy, weird things.
And you're working on some documentaries in the paranormal field. You're an expert on UFOs. You're going to have some fun.
I think so. I mean, you know, when you get to talk to the best of the best and they're not afraid to tell you anything because at that point, you know, you're in a position of, come on, give it to us all. Let's go. You know, nobody wants to hide anything at this point. And I appreciate that. That's the only way we're going to figure out the answers. And, you know, it's been fun listening to you tonight, by the way, too. That spider and that guy.
Oh,
not fun.
Everywhere. Well, let you have the time of your life. We'll talk to you even more after the program, Connie. But enjoy the ride.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it. Have fun tonight, and thanks for listening to me tomorrow.
You got it. Connie Willis, she's going to be doing some programs for us. And as we expand our hosting duties, and so I'm looking forward to that, and make sure you're listening on our Saturday Coast to Coast show. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie with our special guest for the next 2 hours, Peter Biebergall. We're talking about his work, Season of the Witch, and its incredible effect of how the occult saved rock and roll. Now, that's an interesting take, Peter. How did the occult save rock and roll?
Well, I think that the essential spiritual quality of rock and roll is its rebellion. And of course, there's within the context of popular music, and especially in the 60s and early 70s, rock was a vehicle for expressing social rebellion, for expressing sexual rebellion, political rebellion, even personal rebellion. But it was also an attempt to express a spiritual rebellion, a spiritual revolution. And people were, particularly young people, were looking away from mainstream religion to find a spiritual solution to what they saw as a chaotic world.
They were very frustrated.
Very frustrated. And unfortunately, for many of the youth, the post-World War II Christian sort of edifice wasn't doing its job. So many of these people looked towards the East. They looked towards mysticism and yoga and Hinduism. They also looked to the past. They looked to the natural world and the way the Romantics, the Romantic poets and artists, had looked towards sort of pre-Christian values around nature and around the human desire to have an immediate and direct spiritual experience. And I think that that's really, in many ways, what characterizes it, that it is an experience that need not be mediated by a priest or by a rabbi or by any particular text or creed. It's an experience that you have control of, that you can have as you will. And of course, LSD was a big part, and other psychedelic drugs, of giving the individual sort of ownership of their own consciousness and ownership of their own spiritual life, They weren't bound by any creed or church, and yet at the same time they needed community. They needed a sense that they weren't necessarily going it alone, that they could do things like, you know, the stunt that the Hoffman pulled of gathering all the people around the Pentagon and trying to levitate it, right? In the 60s, as a sort of a both. But again, what's very interesting about that is here you have this political stunt using the language of the occult, using the language of this kind of spiritual rebellion. And of course, if you want to rebel, if you're let's move this into the realm of rock and roll as a product, as something that you're still trying to sell. What better way to announce to the world that you're dangerous than to glom on to these symbols as a way of identifying the rebellious spiritual instincts that are driving the music?
Why do people think, Peter, that the belief in the occult is also the belief in Satan, the devil, evil, demons? Because they really do. Most people, if you went on the street and said, hey, what's the occult? They're going to say, oh my God, you're a devil worshiper.
Absolutely. That was one of the most frustrating things I found in the research. And even when I would tell friends, they say, what's this new book you're working on? Oh, I'm writing about the occult influence on the history of rock and roll. And they would say, oh, so I guess you're writing about all the Satanists. And I would say, well, I mean, maybe there's a part of a chapter on that, but it's certainly not the full story. And you're absolutely right. And I think the part of that is because, you know, and I don't want to sound like I'm picking on Christianity here.
I understand.
But we have to be clear about where these ideas came from. And for the most part, the idea that anything that was alternative religious practice, particularly those practices that say are pre-Christian, were more often than not accused of being of the devil. And that was both for political reasons, but also for spiritual reasons. If you're trying to create a community around one idea of salvation, it was very important historically to make sure that you positioned yourself apart from other religious traditions and other ways of believing. Unfortunately, though, that often became an us versus them and a God versus devil type of thing. And so you have this, and we see this as early in one of the things I take up in Season of the Witch is when we look at the roots of rock and roll musically and we trace it to things like the blues and gospel music, and we begin to trace those themselves back to the original practices and music of the slaves, American slaves, and the spirituals that they sang. What we see there is we see that while the slaves themselves were absorbed into Christianity and were in many ways forcibly converted to Christianity, that even though, and many of them accepted that because it was a promise of salvation for them for a life that was mostly horrible. And if you were told that, don't worry, when you die, you're going to be rewarded in heaven as long as you do what your master says and you believe in Christ, you'll be okay. They also knew that in the Bible was the story of Exodus, which was a story of freedom for slaves. So that was something that was important for them to hold on to. But if you look at the way the slaves actually worshiped, even their Christianity, those very elements, the kinds of music, the rhythm, the shout, the ring shout, it was called, often done in private, often done in secret in the woods in what were called hush harbors. These were practices that were taken directly from their roots in Africa, in the religions there that were not Christian at all, but we might characterize, at least from an anthropological point of view, either pagan or animistic, polytheistic. And so if you are the Christian if you are the Christian master and you catch your slaves, even though they're singing about Jesus, but they're stomping in a circle and yelling and raising their voices.
You think it's evil.
Accuse that of barbarism, of being demonic.
That is so true. What was your favorite so-called occult group? rock group.
Well, I mean, again, what's interesting about that is, you know, which of these groups and which of these people actually practiced, who was maybe just a young fellow or a young woman interested in these things because they had money and access to things, they had more freedom to explore alternative kinds of things. I still think some of the great bands that really, I think, shaped and changed rock and roll in many ways, not only because of their music, and I never want to limit that. I'm not trying to undermine the accepted history of rock and roll. I just want to say that there's this very important and essential thread that we have to be mindful of, this occult thread. I think Led Zeppelin and I think David Bowie in particular are the two standouts that really shaped a reimagining of what rock and roll could be and how it could be enhanced by this whole mystique, by a whole mythology, by a whole way of thinking that there is a secret language here and that the fans themselves could, or the media could speculate and say anything they wanted about it. And sometimes the musicians themselves would play coy, right? And they'd say, well, you know, we don't really mean it, but maybe later they would say that they did. I'll give you a very funny example if we have a minute in this slide. In an interview with Jimmy Page, when he was a young man and Led Zeppelin was becoming very, very famous, and here's a guy who suddenly has access to a lot of money, and he started to become interested in Aleister Crowley and in magic, and he would start buying these very expensive and rare volumes, first editions of Aleister Crowley's work. He eventually opened up a bookstore, an occult bookshop called the Equinox, named after Aleister Crowley's magazine journal, a selection of readings that he put together at the time, and bought one of Crowley's homes called the Bullskin House, where Crowley supposedly performed some very dangerous magical experiments. And when reporters would ask this young Jimmy Page about this, he would say, well, you know, Aleister Crowley, he's a great figure of liberty and of personal freedom, and he could change, you know, we need to look to him as somebody who can change the world. Okay, great. So that helps elevate the mystique of Led Zeppelin as somebody who's an occult band or they have this interest in these things. And in a very recent interview with Rolling Stone, here's a much older Jimmy Page,
still at it.
And the interviewer says to Jimmy Page, he says, so tell me about your interest in Aleister Crowley when at the peak of Led Zeppelin. And Jimmy Page says, why does everybody always ask me about Aleister Crowley? Why don't you ask me about, you know, Dante Rossetti, who I loved as an artist when I was a kid? And my answer would have been, well, you set it up. You created this mystique around it. You told everybody that you thought Aleister Crowley was a prophet of a new age. And so there's a sense that, you know, it's hard to know when so much of it was the age that they themselves were living in, the culture themselves, how they fed off of each other, right? And maybe as they get older, maybe they're more private about those things, or maybe it's not as important because the world they're living in is different.
What about today? Are musicians still dabbling in the occult? I don't hear much about that.
I think they're dabbling in the imagery, especially, you know, we see that with, you know, Madonna's amazing Super Bowl halftime show looked like an Egyptian mystery cult initiation. And I think she knew very wisely and smartly as a performer and as a shrewd businesswoman, that these continue to be symbols and images that key very quickly into the human psyche, that you don't even have to believe in these things to somehow be entranced by them, to be hypnotized by them. We see how a lot of hip-hop artists will flash Masonic symbols and things. And
yeah.
Are they Masons or are they, you know, who knows? We'll never know.
Are they just playing a game?
Are they just playing a game? But it's a smart game. And here's why. Because when we go to watch a magician perform stage magic, and I've said this a number of times and I say it in the book, that we know that there's a trick. We know that we could be shown how it's done and that maybe with enough practice we could do it ourselves. And yet when we go into that auditorium or that room, we want to be hypnotized. We want those things to transport us. We want to believe in magic in that moment.
We do.
Maybe when we leave, then we talk about, oh, I know how he did it. But when we're in there, we completely give over to that experience.
We might want to find out, but deep down inside, Peter, we really want to be tricked.
I think so. And what is it about rock and roll and the performance of rock and roll and the spectacle of rock and roll that has given us that same transmission of the magician and the audience? And I think we can look back at the history of religion, the history of magic as it was part of the earliest forms of religion, and we could probably say that this is exactly what was going on with the shaman and the tribe. That there was this sense of giving over to this sense of wonder, to this sense of transcendence, maybe to a sense of ecstatic sense that we could be liberated from our normal day-to-day activities and be transported into something that is completely unreal and that feels somehow connected to some greater reality. And isn't it funny that something like a rock and roll band could make us feel that way? And I think that the reason why that they have been able to do that is, one, because there really is what you're saying, this desire on our parts to be tricked.
Yep.
And that I think they are tapping into some very ancient primal instincts that we can see in the myth stories of gods like Dionysus, these wanting to be burned by the god at the same time that we are seized with ecstasy. But at the same time, I think it's because these musicians understood, either consciously or unconsciously, that these symbols and these ideas would captivate the public imagination.
Peter, Elvis Presley, was he in on this?
Well, his own church would have said that he was. But Elvis himself, in some really interesting interviews, said, you know what, my church that I grew up in is saying that, you know, I'm doing the devil's music, the way that I move and the way that I sing. And you know what he said? He said, but I learned that there. I learned it in my church.
He did. He learned how to move and sang those songs and stuff.
And those songs, those very same ways of worshiping, can be traced directly to the slave spirituals and, again, back to those early African ways of worship. And so the irony there is that the worship of things like the Assembly God Church or the Pentecostal churches, who were using what they had gleaned from the way the slaves worshiped and the way the slaves sang as being a potent means to worship God, was itself in its origins pagan practice.
We're going to come back in just a moment, Peter. I want to take phone calls with a lot of people who are really into this. But when you look at all of this, the occultism, the Satanism aspect, was there one guy who worked with all these bands and groups? Because how did they all pick up on this?
Well, there's a couple, you know, definitely there's a couple of people that made their way through the, the arts that, you know, so you have somebody like Kenneth Anger, for example, who was an underground filmmaker and also a Crowley devotee. And he really wanted his later films, to be magical rituals filmed. And he got to know the Rolling Stones for a time. Eventually he got to know Led Zeppelin. I think he had a different impact on each of those bands. Ultimately, I think he often had a falling out. Who's to blame?
Sure. But then he'd probably go to a different band. Peter, stay with us. We're going to come back, talk more with you. Season of the Witch. I'm George Norrie. Back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM.